This interview with Bill Gertner was recorded on April 14, 2021, during the Baltimore Youth Film Arts Workshop, Inside Stories, Perspectives on Incarceration.
When I started to implode 5 years before I went to prison, my life became unmanageable due to a long, lasting life of being a functional alcoholic and never taking a time out to find out who I was, but just from the age of probably 12 on, right on till the fat till 2005, I realized that I never knew who I was, and I was raised to be someone on the outside that had nothing to do with the way I was being raised on the inside, if that makes sense. So what happens is, and I'm sure a lot of us realize that, When we live in a certain structure at home, and if it's not strong foundation, we leave the house every day. We putting our mask on, walking out into society, trying to be what we think society wants us to be, instead of where our roots are and where's our strong foundation. And when there's no family roots, like I had. I did not have the society owns you, and guess what? That just doesn't work. So, and a long story short, I kept going and going and going, and I did so many things in my life to try to make a name in society. And it was, and the harder you try to do that, well, you lose your foundation. So, long story short, that's what. And I came to realize that. After being a basketball player in college, and after being a theology student for the priesthood, and then a college coach, basketball coach, and then owner, partner in three different IT consulting businesses in the Baltimore-Washington corridor, I realized, and two failed marriages, and leaving a daughter, and I realized that alcohol finally had taken over. I was semi-homeless and about to be homeless the next day, July 5th, 2005. And I was standing in the middle of Route 83 in Timonium, Deerco Road, trying to get run over by trailer trucks because I realized I could not start a new life. And fortunately, the police grabbed me, threw me in jail, and that's why I'm here today, 2005 to 2021. So wow. I was standing out on the highway trying to get run over by trailer trucks right there in Deerco Road, not right north of Timonium, on Route 83. And the traffic was stopped on both sides. I can still see the red lights, and it was like it was unbelievable the amount of fire trucks and it just and God really no one got hurt, and it was diabolical. I knew what I was doing. I was not that drunk. I had just come from the University of Maryland coaches golf tournament, and I had help put that together over the years, that kind of situation with the coaches there. And I realized when I left, I had nothing left to give. I helped put all these guys together prior years. And there I was with nothing, about to be homeless the next day. I could not pay my rent. And I had no idea what to do. And so I just gave up and I ran out on the highway. And fortunately, it stopped, and the police came running, stopped the traffic on Route 83, and the Holy Spirit put me here today to talk with all you guys, especially younger people. Everyone basically knew I had a problem, and obviously the older one gets, without identifying it, gets worse, and so you go through dry periods, and then you go through periods that people say, what's wrong with you? And my good friends would call me on it, and I say, yeah, I got it, I'm good. And so eventually just people gave up on me and just, you know, I guess just let me go and be who I wanted to be. And that was just completely dysfunctional. yeah, it was a pretty good life in one way. But then, as he said, there were two sides to me, and it doesn't work that way. And if you think you have an issue that you're not comfortable with at your age, you've got to attack it. You got to be transparent. You got to throw it out there because we're not unique. Our situations are, you know, a little bit different, but we all have situations growing up at different stages in life. And as a student, as you guys are students getting ready to go to the next step in your life, going on the outside, the order of the day is transparency with yourself first and with someone else. Don't try to hide anything. If you think you have a problem, roll it out there. There's so many people who want to help. I am asked this question so many times. What is different now that in your new life that what's the first thing you noticed when you got out of prison and you were essentially rehab? The first thing was so easy. There's so many good people in society who in their communities who really want to help. And they're offering and in any way, shape, or form. There's so many good people who want to help. So if you think you have an issue, you can get help. And there's no reason to go hide. So that's just one of the fundamental issues. I'm your basic 61-year-old white guy with gray hair and no tattoos. So immediately everyone takes a look at that and say, well, what's this guy in for? So the experience was one that changed my entire life. And I had this story today. We were in another class. And so when you're in prison, you have to get a job. So in my age, that there was very few things for me to do. So what they do is they put you, they give you a broom and put you on a cleanup crew in the cell area, whatever it was called. So I started sweeping the hallway with the broom. And they said, well, you're doing too good. It only takes about 10 minutes in this entire tier. And so I said, okay. So I swept it quickly and took the broom back to the guards. And they said, good job, OG, old guy. And I said, thank you. And so when I went back to my cell that night, I said, holy cow. I started thinking, I said, well, you decided you want to live. So instead of dying, in order to start living, you have to do everything to be the best you can possibly be. So the next day I took that broom and I cleaned the place like it was never cleaned before. And so what it did with that broom, it taught me, it gave me a sense of purpose. It gave me a change agent to work with, the broom. The broom was my coach. It was my keeper. And it was my conduit to a new life. And it made me think of everything that's possible. And what I do every day, less is more. And that you don't need a lot to change your life. You don't need money. You don't need any, you don't need a lot of programs. You just need to decide that you want to change. So that was the first lesson in incarceration. And then the second thing I learned was there are so many bright, intelligent, young men in prison. And it's a shame that sitting around over a period of 8 years that I was in, how many times I would sit in prison rec rooms around rec tables listening to stories about these young men, most of them from Baltimore or the District of Columbia, talking about their lives. And I got to realize that most of these young men quit life in middle school. So they would come home from middle school. They got cut from their basketball team. There were no clubs for them. There was nothing for them to do. There were no male role models at home. And a lot of times the mother was working, or there was no mother, and the grandmother was home. And I would listen to these stories, and I would say, oh my gosh, if these guys had the chance that I had, they wouldn't be here. And because most young men never had that chance. So, and that I learned that in prison. There's beautiful men in prison that never had a chance. This is second chance months, right? I refuse to call it second chance month. It is a first chance month to me, because most people, 60% of the people, and I've dealt with 400 or 500 people in my office in the last 7 years, most people never had a first chance. I'm so adamant about that. So there's a couple of lessons I learned. Our whole program is called The Business of Living. And there are four components to it. Every day, you get educationally, you get smarter. Every day, occupationally, you get better at your job. Every day, personally, you become a better person. And then there's three for three. Then the fourth thing is a spiritual component to that. There has to be a spiritual component to building a new life or rebuilding a life. And that we really hone in on that. And of course, we say spirituality is not reading the Bible only. It's not going to church. It's understanding that you are a spiritual being. We all have a soul. It makes us different from the animals. So in this soul, when we came out of our mommy's bellies, we didn't come out locked up, ready to go to prison. We came out smiling with freedom, with love, with hope, with joy, with wisdom. We had that with us, so we own that. So when you come into our Business of Living program, we put you on a dartboard and we put you right on the bullseye, and this is where you are. And you've got to go through these gates to get to where you really want to be. It's not going to be easy, but if you want to do it, we have the resources that could take you wherever you need to go if you buy into our four components. And it's not a lot of money. It's just a lot of using the available resources for the people that are available here. And guess what? 3 out of 15 men and or women will take advantage of that. And we know this after doing this for several years. But 3 out of 15 will just give it all they have, you know,
yeah.
Because they're afraid of failure again. It's just difficult. So when we go to jail, emotionally or materially, we're spent, and probably both. So therefore, you go into corrections now, and what happens inside the prison is just completely, unless you've been there, you can't understand it. A prison is just like a city. So it has all the elements. It's got a gym, it's got a church, it's got a school, it's got a library, it's got meeting rooms, it's got a health care, it's got gangs, it's got contraband, and it's got ugly people, and it's got good people. It's just like any town. It's just like any city. So that is what we're facing when we get out. So when someone gets out, they really have nothing. They're the new Secretary of Public Safety for the state of Maryland the last 2 years, Mr. Rob Green, is doing a tremendous job of fulfilling reentry and transition positions that have been left unfilled. And so he's doing a great job. But prior to that, so many people were getting out and they didn't even have an ID or a Social Security card. So guess what? You couldn't get a job. You could not get a job without an ID. And that still happened. We dealt with one of those today. And so when someone gets out, they probably have not, they've been sitting around a long time while they've been locked up, especially during this pandemic. And so, and a lot of them, there's no families involved. The family is dysfunctional to begin with, and there was no family there in the middle, and there's no family in the end. So, I would say that's, I would say 40% of the people get out have no families. My immediate family, my brother was fine. He was a retired prison warden from the state of Pennsylvania, ironically. And it was very difficult on him to face our family when it was a surprise that they found out I was locked up. And so he, like my good friends, they had almost an approach avoidance. They wanted to see what it's like. They were waiting to see what my reaction would be. Was I going to go drink again? That was the first thing, alcohol. And then my daughter, who at that time was going through medical school, she wanted nothing to do with me. And she would write letters to me, but she was so embarrassed. Baltimore is a big, small town. And so, as you guys know, and so she had to face some of that stuff, and questions and stuff like that. Yeah, it is domestic violence and alcohol that fueled my arrest. And, so it was not a pretty picture. But, so now, but because of my mission to rehab and obviously never drink or drug again, people appreciate what I've been trying to do and what we've been able to get done. And I do that every day because if any of you people have been, I'm not here espousing how great prisoners are, because a lot of the prisoners really have it difficult. And so there's a third who can't really shake it. They belong locked up. Then there's a third in the middle who really these need help, but they can come out and be productive citizens. And then there's a third like me who have a chance and who have been in situations and want to rehab and do a good job. So I say it's a third, a third, a third. So, family is important if there is family, that, you know, because you feel so isolated, Michelle, when you go in. When the judge gives you a sentence and he said, pronounces a year, years, how many years? I didn't even hear him because I was so mixed up in my mind. And I asked the bailiff, how many years did he say? And he said 15. And when he said 15, everything, it was like my body just went numb. It was that I could feel the hope flushing out of my body, not the blood, but hope. Hope is such a big word in prisons. And I can honestly say from that moment when the judge says that, then you just say, oh my gosh, I have no hope. My life is over. I had people, who knew me very well. And, they started writing me letters, and it was really one letter that turned me around. One man wrote to me and said that he forgave me and he knew that I had an issue and he was sorry he never grabbed me and told me. So he took a little bit of the blame, which obviously whether he meant it or not, it didn't matter because it really helped me. And that man drove up from Atlanta the day I got out of prison and brought me clothes. So it's not only family, it's friends. So, and I take this seriously because this is how gatekeepers it evolved, that we try to meet people at the gate. We work with the state reentry coordinator up here, and she will tell us when someone's coming. If they're coming to Washington County, they say, do you want to pick them up? And here's where they have to go. And yes, we do, because I want to be the first person there if that person doesn't have a family. I know what that means. It does, yes. Yeah, the hope changes because that's when you start to build a new life. And as I said, when people get out and they come in this room, we have the bullseye. You're in the bullseye until you start using people. You can't do it yourself. So you immediately, when you will go into prison, you think that, well, I'm going to get this done. I'll get it done myself. But you can't get it done without other people. So immediately you get hope by talking with other people. And you become friends, you become acquaintances, There's such a diverse group of people, and you find out there's so many great people. I've met some of my lifelong friends I've met in prison, and we get together a lot from different parts of the state. Some of them from living in New York, and we still get together. So there's, you know, so it's like a foxhole mentality. It's, we'll survive together. We can't survive alone. No, Stan. What it did for me, it taught me how to meditate. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate enough to have a Buddhist as my first cellmate, and he could twist his whole body up into like a pretzel, and I knew how to pray. I thought, but learning how to meditate was incredible. The yoga had meditative foundation out of California has a great lessons for inmates, which they send twice a month. And so I started following that, and that's a great question, because, you know, claustrophobia is huge in prison. And so, you know, just, you know, necessity is a mother invention. I learned that in prison. So whatever you want, you have to invent. Yeah, it's much better, Anna. Thanks a lot. And she's a physician in Baltimore, and we don't talk, we text, and we text a lot. So, and her mother passed away, and as part of my rehabilitation, when her mother got sick with cancer, and it was coming to she needed help. I just threw everything. I locked my door here and went down to Baltimore and lived with her for 2 months on and off to take care of her while my daughter, you know, was still in medical school in Philadelphia. And that was a blessing. That was really, I got the opportunity to do that. And that was amazing. That was more rehabilitation there than anything. So Morgan, 2 weeks before that, I realized that my life, I couldn't start. I didn't have any money. I was pretty effective in putting people together in the technology business and getting contracts. I was done with that. I had no dreams. I had no vision. You know, I think, you know, we heard it when the food guy committed suicide a while ago. He said he ran out of dreams. And I remember thinking that same thing. Yeah, you know, when you stop dreaming, you know, life could stop. You can't stop dreaming ever. And so I said I couldn't dream of anything else I could do. I couldn't reinvent myself. I had done it so many times. But and I said, so what else am I going to do? And, you know, and I just, my whole life was just worthless. It was useless. I was a burden. I was, you know, just I walked up and down Pedonia Road, if you know where that is. For almost 2 hours, you know, just walking up and down, and it was like July, I don't know what it was, but and I was ready. I wanted to jump out in front of a truck, and I came so close, but then I chickened out, and that was 2 weeks before I did I did the other thing. All I wanted to do was commit suicide. Looking at how many ways. If you could stand up in this one ledge and you dive off in your head, how many times I wanted to do that. And then I just thought, well, that wouldn't work. And it was just, you know, it was one thought after another. And it was 5 months of that till I got to prison. And then I got to prison and things became different. As time evolved, you have to start thinking, is there life after prison? Well, I was definitely getting out. I wasn't there for life. And so as much as I tried not to think about it, I said, what am I going to do when I grow up? What am I going to, you know, you're at that point. How am I going to invent myself? I'm a new person. I'm sober. I'll never drink again. And I'll be a good person. I'm not going to lie. I knew I had a Social Security check coming. So I was going to get somewhere around 70 when I got out. So that was enough to live in a small town. I could never go back to Baltimore with that. But a place like Hagerstown or Salisbury or someplace like that, I was thinking, well, I can go there and try to get a job, with social worker. I was thinking, because I was told that with my background, I could probably get a job in social work. Yeah, I started writing a lot. I wrote a lot of letters. And if any of you people, if you want to do something, write a letter to an inmate, because letters have souls. And I got to realize that when I was in prison. Someone sits down and writes you a letter, and you're sitting in a cell, and you have this dastardly clothes on, and you have this ugly smell, and you have rats, and this is the old penitentiary, and this is fact. When someone writes you a letter and you're in jail and you open that letter and you read every letter, it doesn't matter if it's a paragraph or two paragraphs, every letter becomes a story. You think of that person sitting there writing to you. And it's a beautiful rehabilitative thing. These letters keep coming in, and I got to know, and the jobs I had, I got to be able to help people and help people write letters, help people give books away. I had basketball coaches, friends in college. They'd send me the yearbooks, the Maryland book, the West Virginia book, the University of Connecticut book, places where I used to work. And so a lot of I was able to get in touch with a lot of young men and old guys too, but to be able to see what their future lies and what they needed and where they were. And I started writing programs. What would it look like? What would and there, it became the foundation for what I'm doing now. We categorize here three ways. It's not a tense. We see a person walks in the door, they're either 0, 5, or 10. 0 means they got no shot. They're so damaged mentally, and their mental health is a component that just, it's just crazy getting out of prison. And then 0, 5, and then 5 are the people who we really want to work with. But the 10, the people who are 10 come in, we put them to work with us to help the people on 5 and 0. So we have a lot we call peer coaches. So a lot, we're all volunteers. No one gets paid here at Gatekeepers, including me. I just take expenses. And we have nice volunteers who send us money, and we let people manage that for us. So what really is frustrating is not the people who don't have a chance, but you just try, you give them everything they can. It's the people who don't who could have a chance but won't accept it. They will take the resources. If they come to us, we buy them a phone right away. We give them we buy them two sets of clothes. We take them out shopping, we give them a business of living seminars and try to give them coaches, mentors, and if they don't accept that, they just go off the rails so quickly, and that's what's frustrating. It gave me, I had the tools. I do have a faith, strong faith, and it gave me the tools that I say that God gave me. I was a successful athlete, a successful basketball coach, a successful businessman, and a very unsuccessful father and husband and friend. But I knew I had the tools to do it. And I picked those up in prison. Like that broom was the biggest tool that I've ever had in life, because in 24 hours, I took that broom, and it taught me to be the best broom sweeper that Roxbury Institution ever had. And so that's the lesson I give everyone, one of the first lessons here. Whatever it is, the job you get is the most important job you ever have. So all of us, if we don't do this, when we wake up in the morning with the purpose to say, I'm going to be the best I can possibly be every day, then we're wasting time. And that has nothing. That's all of us. If we don't want to be the best student that day, if we're not going to be the best, whatever it is, it just doesn't make sense, because you people all have a soul and you know what you're doing being on this call for a reason. So God put us all together for this. And so one thing I would like to carry through is that every day we wake up, we have to, our stock has to be up. We either live or die, start living, start dying. And if we don't be the best, we try to be the best every day, then we're wasting the talent that we have and that God gave us. So yeah, the tools that I had were really honed going to prison. It took coaching, teaching, business development, everything, community support, everything that I ever done is right was honed in prison. Yeah, I think there was a purpose, and I've said before, I think that, you know, following God's plan, if we're believers, there is a plan for all of us. And obviously that had to be my plan, Stan. I think the sentencing is unfair, but not for me. I mean, I can't ask that. I appreciate that question. And Greg would be a good answer, give an answer to this one too. But I think the sentences are too long. I think, you know, and how they run the prisons, that although this guy is better now, I mean, it was really warehousing, especially the detention centers and stuff. So if we expect men and women to come back into society from being in prisons and make it better, it's got a long way to go. And they're trying now as much as ever. I've seen it, you know, such an uptick in the last 2 years. But when I was in prison, I agree, you know, it was just hopeless. And we talked about hope earlier. There's not a hell of a lot of hope in prison because of the nature of it and the evilness that's in there. And so sentences are too long. The obviously profiling is just ridiculous. And my whole mantra is poverty. You know, there's a lot of poverty in Baltimore that you were with. Hagerstown is a miniature Baltimore, very miniature. The poverty here is incredible. And a lot of it is from what I'm going to say. Poverty caused by incarceration is the worst form of violence. And I would bet if they take all the stuff that happens in our city of Baltimore and in this region up here, this tri-state region, there's a lot of violence. I bet a lot of it's tied in with people who had been incarcerated. And so if we're going to incarcerate people and expect them to get out without any program or without any hope, this violence is going to continue.
one day. And I told him that a group of us would like to start a program in the course while we're here to talk to the first time youth offenders that's coming here. Because, like I said, I was nervous, I was scared. People was tricking you when you went in there. People was raping you and molesting you and things of that nature. And this stuff was still going on. And I explained that to the warden that, these guys coming here with nothing, and they asked to bar things, not understanding, the rules and regulations of this different world, of being in a different world other than being outside in another world, and a lot of times they would fall in the trap. So they allow us to start, this Youth Act program that while we was in there. I started a new job. Once I got out of that, I went into this other job called MCI program. It's like where you make the most money in the program, but we was printing up license stickers, yearly stickers and stuff like that to go on to cars and stuff like that for motor vehicle, they didn't contracts. So we was doing that. And I learned to do that. One of the things I learned is how to run a printing press. It's called an ABJ printing press and stuff like that. So I learned to do that with that. You have to choose and decide what you want to do with your time. You have to sit back and ask yourself, do you want to further go down the rabbit hole, or do you want to change, your way of life, And it's real hard to do that because I say, like, you're in a different world and there's so much going on around you and your mentality change, while you're there. So I made the choice, to try to say, I'm going to do something with my life because I don't even know if I'm going to make it home or not with a 50-year sentence. It's like having a life debt. It makes you feel good. It's more than making you feel good because first, let me get back to this. And I don't want to be redundant. I'm Muslim, and it gives you a different perspective on how to look at life, and how to look at another human being, whether you Muslim, Jew, Christian, whatever, atheist, whatever. It gives you a different perspective to look at life and how to respect it, So what you say, you have to be that. You couldn't just say something to somebody in there and not allow it to be your character. So it made me feel good that the things that I was saying to the guys that was coming in, that some of them was older than me, some of them wasn't older than me. It made me feel good to say the things that I was saying to them because I had to be what I was saying. My model had to be that inside of the jail. When we stepped out of this room and going back into, the jail system, you have to be that. And them guys looked at you real close, and they draw closer to you because they felt a sense of protection that everybody looked for when you go in there. Even the strongest guys, like when I talk about Little Melvin, Sim Charles, Stakem and stuff like that, even the guy from The Wire, they're my closest friends, Chris Warren and all of them, Bodie, all of them, they're my closest friends. These are guys I come up with. Even us, we cry. We feel a sense of abandonment. We feel like, we left alone and there's nobody there for us. So you have to, pull yourself together and you have to make a serious decision. Now, I didn't make this decision when I first went in there. I still had a street mentality. It was kill or be killed. Do what you had to do. You have to be there first, to find out, how do I deal with this world in here? How do I deal with all these ills that I heard about what's going on in here? You know what I mean? And again, I've seen guys trick dudes out of their butt. I've seen dudes trick, and some of them was the best of friends. I heard a dude, and he was talking about paying off his bill. He said he had another court to go through. He had already had a 30-year sentence. It was a white guy. And he said he don't think he can handle another, some more time. And it was a commissary day. And everybody was going up to the chow when he was coming back from commissary. He said, I'm going to pay all y'all off that I owe y'all. He said, y'all can take this right here. He said, the rest of y'all, when y'all come back, it'll be in my cell. Now, his cell was next door to me. And again, I worked in an MCI shop. So that's the best job you can get in the system. I came down to go to commissary just to put my stuff in my cell and then go back to work. So I didn't go to chow that day. So I heard something, and I had made my salat because my prayer came in. But I heard something kicking on the wall real hard, kicking on the wall real, real hard and stuff. I knocked on the wall, right? And I said, boy, you all right over there? And it wouldn't, never said nothing. So when they came back from chow, he had hung himself. He had hung himself. You open up all the doors when you come back from chow, but you got to get in your cell. And I stepped out there to look at him and make sure he was all right. But he had hung himself, you know. And it messed me up real bad, you know, because that wasn't the first hanging I saw. But he was actually a good dude, you know. I mean, we made mistakes, stuff like that, you know, but he was actually a good dude. You know, that wasn't the only hanging I saw. I saw a lot. You know, being in prison for 30 years, you see a lot. I'm going to give you two, and I'm going to try to make it as brief as possible. I'm gonna give you two of the experiences that I saw. Well, I'm gonna give you three, and I'm gonna make them real brief. Young guy, younger than me at the time, I had grown a little older then. I probably was in my mid-20s, maybe late-20s. Was on the phone talking to his young lady, telling her that, you know, don't leave, hold on. You know, I got a kid, but you say I'm going back to court. He said. And the judge talking about taking most of my time back. That means I would only have to do a year. You can hear him because he's talking real loud. And at this time, they had put phones on the tears. And he was talking real loud and stuff like that. And he was like, don't leave me. And started crying and stuff like that. And the officer, you know, told him he had to hold it down because he was loud and talking to his girl. So she must have hung up on him because he kept saying, you dead. And he tried to call back, and she wouldn't accept the call. He asked the officer to let him lock in and stuff. And he went and locked in. And about a half an hour, maybe to an hour later, you know, the tier he was on was a traffic tier. And what that means, you had to come through his tier to get to other tiers, you know. And one of his friends was coming up this through the tier to go to his cell. I mean, to go to his tier, looked in his cell, and he had hung himself. He was hanging from the bars, and when the officer opened up the grill, everybody ran down to his cell, you know, and they were telling the officer, open the door so we can grab and try to put him up to see if he was still living. Mm-hmm. But the officer, you can't do that. You got to leave the scene exactly the way it is, you yeah. know. And the officer wouldn't open the door. He wouldn't even go in there and do it until the warden came up and nurses from the infirmary came up. So we felt that sense of betrayal, you know, knowing that the system didn't have our best interests at heart. When gangs started getting popular in the jail, this guy, he, you know, his family was real supportive of him. So, and we get packages. We had package months and all that type of stuff. You know, and this guy, he would take certain guys and say, let me get a package in your name that wasn't getting packaged. He said, I'll get my mother to buy you a couple pair of jeans and I'll get my mother to buy you some tennis, you know, because he wanted to get it, you know, have a lot of clothes. Mm-hmm. So this particular dude, I knew the dude too, come out of Lexington Terrace. You know, he was in the game, Black Gorilla, whatever they call him. What's the name?
Family.
Exactly.
BFG, Black Gorilla right. Family.
That's right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they went to him to lean on him and tell him to go get us some of this. And he told me, he said, man, you must be crazy. I'm not getting you anything. He said, all right, so I'm not, you know, scared of that. So we went in the yard that evening. And in jail, you can tell when something can happen because you feel that all around you, so you know it. You know, you feel that vibe going around you, and everybody back is to the wall. You know, so I walk out in the yard, and one of the guys say, you know, I used to like to run the yard. He used to say, Basim, hold on, man. He said, something great happened. And lo and behold, Wagner turned around, you can hear a bat cracking. The dude hit the dude with the bat in the head and cracked his skull. Mm-hmm. He died. He died. They sent in an ambulance to lift him up out of there, but the guy died. We had to go in this place called the Annex. So they moved a lot of us off the tier because off of certain tiers because asbestos was all through the tier and the fungus and stuff was falling up the wall. So while they was working on it and closed down the tier, they sent us in this place called the Annex. It's like a dorm. Mm-hmm. You got three parts to this dorm. You know, so we had one tier in this dorm, one tier in that dorm, one tier. And you can interact with each other and stuff like that. This guy that I know that come out of Murphy Holmes, and another guy that came out of another part of Murphy Holmes, was there. And the older guy, and the guy was real small. He was leaning on the younger guy. He was always take his commissary, always go through his packets and stuff like that. And the younger guy would always report to the officers what the guy was doing. And he wanted to be moved from the tier or moved out of jail. And they would just discount it and throw it away and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So when they moved us down in the annex, and they had a gym period, and a guy told him, and it was a commissary day, and he told me, he said, when I come back, excuse my language, he said, my commissary shit better be on my bed. The young guy said, I'm tired of this, man. I'm not going to allow you to do this to me anymore. This is the last time. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing it. So on the way, when they came back from gym, we get like an hour and maybe 20 minutes to a half an hour in gym. You know, when they came back from gym, he come in there. He called himself being bad. He walked straight to the young guy. And the young guy pulled out an ice pick and stuck him right in his chest. And he left it in his chest. And the dude grabbed his chest and turned around. And what you call, what we got, where officers sit up in the station, we call it the bubble. He tried to walk to the bubble, and before he got to the bubble, he fell. And that's where he died. You know, so, you know, a lot of stuff in prison, yeah, you see. It's like a lot of yes, infection. And you have to you have to mold your life around that because you don't never know when it's going to be someone to challenge you. One thing my mother told me when she put me out, right, she used to always, you know, still be there for me, but she told me, don't you ever think you bad because of someone badder than you. And they will always challenge you because they want to be the most bad one. She said, but always be serious and a man of your word. And I stuck with that. It stuck with me to the day. I'm a serious brother. And I take things real serious. And I try to be a man of my word. And if things change, I go to the person and say, look, I have to do something else. This is what happened. Now, can you bear with me? Or let's just, you know, resolve the issue. You know, and I remember that. And it makes me a better man. Having a strike against you, you know, it always fall in a place where opportunities are lacking, and you are not, you know, given the, you know, the best of the choices that come a person's way. But you have to realize that you put yourself in this position, and you have to make something happen for yourself. You know, society, to me, in a lot of ways, haven't gotten better. It got some ways worse than it was when I went into society because, you know, you did, like, you know, Brother Greg said, you had a more conscious out here on the streets when I went in. You know, men would be men, and they would stick, you know, they lived it by principles and standards and stuff like that. You know, today, youth doesn't live by certain standards or morals and stuff like that. Even when you go into going into a company or a corporation and trying to get a job. You know, when I first came home, I went to this welding company, and my credentials was better than the guy that was before me and after me. And when I went into an interview, she asked me, was I ever incarcerated? I started to lie because I know is a window that you have from 5 to 7 years that they can ask you about your incarceration or put on your application. And I didn't put it on there. And when she went down the application, she asked me, you know, was you ever incarcerated? And I paused. And I was asking myself in my mind, you know, should I tell her the truth or should I lie? You know, and I said, I'm going to tell her the truth because this would be the best way of me getting something, you know, with my belief in God and everything and stuff like that. So I told her, I said, yes, I was incarcerated before. I said, but it'd been a long time ago. It was a while ago. I said, it was back in 1985. I said, I haven't been to prison since then. And then she said, would you mind expounding on what you was incarcerated for? And it kind of, I kind of knew then, right then and there, that I was going to be scratched from this list, right? And I told her, I said, is that a requirement? Do I have to do it? She said, no, you don't have to do it. She said, but I prefer you do it. Okay. I told her, I said, okay, well, I was young. I said, I come out of a drug-ridden area. Some of us would call it probably ghetto and things of that nature. I say, but it was, an area where you grew up and you had to make certain choices. I said, when I was young, I made the wrong choice. I said, I got in a situation where some guys kind of tried to rob me, and I had a gun on me. And I shot one of the guys, and he died. And she said, all right, I don't need to hear no more. But I knew right then and there that society wasn't going to play fair with me, you know, and that I would have to make my own way. But I had to understand, too, on the other side of that coin, no one did this to me but me, you know. So I had to find somewhere to keep trying to put this bitterness that I had with society about me being in incarceration in a place where it wouldn't affect me of doing what I needed to be done, you know. So, yeah, no. I think society plays for it. And sometimes it does. Yes, I appreciate that. I appreciate that, Anna. And you know, it was a blessing to me. You know, and just to piggyback from what you said, right, in terms of strength, a lot of people say to me, right, Fasim, that's my Muslim man. They say, Fasim, tell me the truth. You did 30 years straight. I say, yeah. I say, man, you're not demented. You're not crazy. Nothing like that stuff. I said, I'm blessed by God. I say, so if you call that crazy, then I'm crazy. I said, but no, I'm not crazy. Do I have my moments of psychological effects? I said, yeah, I had them. I said, but everybody has them. You know, I said, but I'm not crazy. I trusted God while I was there, and God brought me through. But when I went to prison, you know, I had a prison experience where I went to a Christian meeting and they was talking about other religious groups on how, you know, if you don't accept Christ, you're going to hell, and you and they this and they that, you know, some of them are nationalists and all. Now, I said to them, this is before I caught my 50-year sentence, I say, why are we talking about other groups? Let's talk about what God can do for us. Because I'm scared because I went in there. My papers, they give you a true bill when you have a murder. Had first degree on there, murder. You don't get the rest of the degrees until you go into court. You know, like first degree, second degree, manslaughter, something like that, or not guilty. You know, so I said, why don't we keep talking about these people? Let's talk about what God going to do for us and what we need to do to change. I don't want to hear that in the outside coordinating them. And I hear the group say, well, if you don't want to hear this, you can leave, right? And I left. And I had already knew two older guys that was in Islam. Asked me, well, I thought you was at your meeting. I said, nah, I just went through something, you know, stuff like that. So they said, well, you're welcome to come to a Talim service, which is a speaking gathering when you go to the Muslim thing. And it made me open my heart to look at other religions. And I seen Islam, I found Islam was the best thing for me. You know, it opened my mind. You know, it gave me a different perspective about people and the world, you know. And it just went from there, you know, just went from there. But I try not to push it on other people because they are who they are, regardless of what it is. You know, I just, you know, leave it to me. And when somebody asks me, then I explain it to them. I would love to do this again whenever you need me. I would love to give back because there's so much to what I have to say in terms of me, that transition from being my first incarceration into my second, you know, and yes, the things that affected me in terms of my second incarceration. So I would love to do this again because I feel like I'm giving back.